Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle Fenton. On October 16, 1968, history was made on the podium for the men's 200-meter dash, and it wasn't just Tommy Smith's record-setting run. As the national anthem played, Smith and silver medalist John Carlos raised their gloved hands to give the Black Power salute in what became one of the most iconic sports moments of all time. When Wyoming Tyus took the podium for gold in the 400-meter relay later in those same Olympics, she wore black shorts and dedicated her medal to Smith and Carlos. Sociologist and civil rights activist Dr. Harry Edwards was one of the architects behind the protest, which was organized by the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Smith, Tyus, and Edwards are here with us today, nearly 50 years later, to discuss the lasting impact of the 1968 Olympic Games on sports and politics. Dr. Tommy Smith, Wyoming Tyus, and Dr. Harry Edwards, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Tommy, let's go back to before you took the podium. You won the 200-meter dash in 19.83 seconds, which was the first time the 20-second barrier had been broken. What were you feeling in the moment where you realized you had set that record and won the gold?
You know, I've been running for a long time, and I ran for, I suppose, the academics of perfection. And I ran to do that, not necessarily to win. And I was talking to Wyoming just the other day that if anybody in a race that defeated me, I congratulated them because they worked harder in practice than I did. And that's what I see as competition, doing the best you can with an academic backing to do just that. That race, which was one of the fastest races I've ever ran, but not exactly the most dramatic in terms of muscle structure. So it was a great experience, the whole thing, even the political part of it, because it was a movement forward, the Olympic Project for Human Rights, brainchild by the Dr. Harry Edwards. And it was a stand that we took for growth, for maturity in the system. And it still stands. The athletes are doing similar things now, showing me anyway that the road is rough, but they are tougher people out there to take charge of the direction, and I'm very proud of that.
And Wyoming, you also had a record-setting performance at the 68 Games. What did it mean to you to be the first person, male or female, to retain the Olympic 100-meter title?
Well, at the time I did it, I don't think I was looking at that. I know I had gone to the 64 Games in Tokyo, Japan, and I was 19. And my coach at Temple had said, well, you know, you made the team, and most people, young people don't make the team so early. And then when I won the gold medal, he said, well, I don't know what to tell you, but 68 is your year. Because I think you'd be strong enough and all that, 68 would be your year. So I was really looking forward to 68 and that. You know, my goals then was that I was going to graduate from college, which I did in August, and then went to the games in 68 in October, and I said I was going to win the 100 meters to myself, never to anyone else. But in my head and my thinking, that's how I wanted to end my career on top. And I was able to do that, but also with a lot of hard work and all of those kinds of things.
Tommy, you said that when you crossed that finish line, you had the smile of elation. And I was wondering if it's elation that you won or that you won so it gave you the platform to be able to go through with this demonstration.
It was a combination of everything. When you in a race like that, the fastest people in the world, it was kind of deciding that now the next step. Because we had worked very hard on this project, the Olympic Project for Human Rights. It was started on the campus of San Jose State University, and that's my alma mater. So I felt it a necessity, and I went the extra step to make sure that the work that was started on San Jose State campus would not fail right at the end, although the boycott was not continued. It was by Carlos and Smith on the victory stand, and victory stand stood exactly for what the Olympic Project for Human Rights pointed out earlier on in its objective responsibilities.
And I do want to get more to the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the planned boycott, but I want to follow up with how, in the wake of all these changes and the changes to the boycott and the plan, did you ultimately decide what form your protest would take?
Very, very few people knew that. When the athletes met the final meeting, for me, the big meeting was in Denver, Colorado, and it was decided there that no, there would not be a boycott, but each athlete would represent himself according to how he felt a country represented them, the feeling one had. So that alleviate the pressure of the athletes doing the same things. So we were academic athletes back in those days, and we thought for ourselves. But that meeting decided the fact that you got to continue to think for yourself now and go the extra mile if you think the extra mile is tolerable for you. And it was for me. And we dedicated our lives to that Olympic Project for Human Rights, which we had worked very hard on a year before. Because I was asked by some of the athletes, man, you got to go to the meetings. And I said, what meetings? They said, the meetings at the Harry then, Dr. Edwards now, is having concerning the need for athletes to become involved in a movement across this country of the ideas that stepping forward is what we must do right now to continue this plow of upturning society so we can see the true light of the evolution. And I said, okay, I'll go. And when I went, I just stared there, you know, did this gargantuan of a person. I thought Harry was big then, you know, but now I'm about this size. So, you know, it's
you caught up. Yeah,
yeah, I'm catching up, you know, catching up. And I got literally drawn in on the truth, in fact, that what was going on, because nothing like this has ever happened before, especially with a group of athletes.
And Dr. Edwards, or Harry, if I may, tell me about the Olympic Project for Human Rights, how it was created and what the platform was.
The Olympic Project for Human Rights was, first of all, about human rights. It was not about civil rights. The goal of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, the central goal, was to bring these high-profile, high-performance athletes into the mainstream as part of the struggle that was going on for African-American black human rights in this country. I met with Dr. King. I met with Floyd McKissick. I was a member of the Black Panther Party with Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale. I also met with a number of other people, civil rights leaders, to try to explain to them how critically important it was for athletes to play a role in this. Dr. King agreed. The only thing that he asked was that athletes not be coerced, that we were not to trade white supremacy on black orthodoxy, that unless you did it this way, unless you did that, then you were not going to be accepted. So the whole concept came out of the history of athlete involvement in black advancement in this country, in human rights advancement in this country. So this was part of a long tradition of historic involvement. We had to figure out how we were going to get that done. I put forth the idea of a boycott, not with the idea that we'd be able to bring about a total coordinated solidary boycott, but you always want your reach to exceed what you're actually able to grasp. So if you put that out there and use that as a way of generating a thought around what is our obligation as a generation, you're going to have athletes who think, who have the courage, who have the intellect, who have the commitment to get that done. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lucius Allen, and Mike Warren boycotted the games. You had a number of other athletes who boycotted the games. But then you had athletes like Smith and Carlos and Wyoming who did other things. But the basic fundamental thing was they made a statement and a contribution to the struggle of their generation. And I'm glad 50 years later we're still talking about it.
What did you feel watching this protest as it unfolded?
I had a lot of different emotions. First of all, you know, I look at Smith and Carlos. Tommy Smith's the greatest sprinter in the history, period. And then to see the statements that were made by athletes from the podium, I think was heartfelt, especially in light of what we had gone through and what they had gone through to get to that place. I knew, because I knew what was happening with the FBI and some of the other law enforcement agencies around surveillance on this project, what the outcome would be. But I thought that these gestures, these dignified, nonviolent, silent gestures, said volumes about where we were as a society and where we might be headed as a nation unless people got involved and began to speak out. Our leaders were being shot down in the street. Our children were being lynched like Emmett Till. Our women and grandmamas and so forth were being washed down the street like basketballs with fire hoses. So it was time for everybody to stand up and speak out. So I was immensely proud of them, tremendously gratified at what they did. And as a sports sociologist, I'm not surprised at all that 50 years later, not only is the demonstration from the podium in Mexico City seen as the most iconic sports image of the 20th century, but we're still talking about it. We're analyzing it. We're trying to wrap our minds around it and understand it.
And Tommy, when asked what you were thinking or doing on your way up to the podium and during the protest, you said you were praying. What did that feel like, those moments you took the podium and raised your fist?
Well, you see, the scaredness part was a long time. The elongation of it was from the time it started till the time ended. So going up to the victory stand, I knew that I had done as much as I could to that point. You know, the victory stand wasn't thought of by other athletes. This was an individual movement by two athletes who thought it a necessity to rally at the end. So moving from the dungeon across the track to the victory stand, all this was going through my mind. I had time to think then. The thought going up all the steps that was made at San Jose State from that training. You had to get there first. And to get there, you had to run a plethora of races just to get to the race, to get you to the trial, to get you to the final. And then there's the final race. I mean, there's a lot to think about through all the forces that you had to maintain before you hit the finish line. So that was on my mind. We had already decided what we were going to do moments before we left the dungeon to cross that track to mount that victory stand. And once I got on the victory stand, I looked at the crowd and I said, "Man, sure there's a lot of people out there." And I heard Wyoming retires. I think she said that as the fist went up, and she still uses this term, "Did you see that?" So it surprised a lot of people, but it didn't surprise the ones who had decided to make this action. And it was an action heard around the world without a word said.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Lindsay Whistle Fenton, and our guests are Dr. Tommy Smith, Wyomee Tyus, and Dr. Harry Edwards, all of whom were involved in the iconic 1968 Olympic protests. Wyomee, no one had reached out to the women's track team to coordinate the protests, but you participated anyway. You wore black shorts on the podium when you accepted your medal, and you dedicated it to Smith and Carlos. Why did you feel compelled to join?
It's all about human rights, and I grew up in Georgia, and coming from the Jim Crow South at that time, we had very little rights, and you're talking about black women that had very no rights, pretty much, when it comes to it. And when you look at what happened in 68, I felt compelled to do it in that it was also, I believed in what was going on and what the whole movement was about. You know, most time when you speak to people, they definitely talk about what Carlos and Smith did, but there were other athletes that also did a whole lot, and it never got it was never televised, so to speak. But we did a lot of other things. They were small things maybe to some people, but to us, those were the things that we could do, because what Smith and Carlos had done, it was no other way to do it. Because when Tommy was saying just now that when they walked out, first of all, I saw they didn't have his shoes on. I went, "Well, what are they doing?" And then they got on their victory stand, and when the national anthem was played, and the hand went up and it bowed their heads, and it was like, "Oh my God, what? I mean, I was just speechless. And for me, I will always remember that day, because what happened, I was sitting in an area where I had direct view of it, and to me, the whole stadium went completely silent. And nothing. And it was like, then you could kind of hear some rumbling. And my first thought was, "Gosh, I hope no one gets hurt here." And then when they walked off the victory stand, it was a lot of whistling, jeering, and also cheering also. But for them to make that stand, and that the stand was not just for them, but I think once athletes start to talk, we all start saying, "What can we do? What can we do?" And they decide, you decided as an athlete what you wanted to do and how you wanted to do it. And that's how it came about for us as a relay team to dedicate our medals to what Tommy and Carlos had done, and the mere fact that they were, you know, how what people were saying about them. But for me, you know, we wanted to show how much we supported them and how much we were behind the whole human rights project.
Tommy, athletes dream their whole lives of winning a gold medal. I mean, that's the dream, and very few people get to do that. What is it like to sacrifice that dream and that achievement for a greater movement? Because most people will remember your stand not for the race you ran, but for the demonstration and the protest you made.
Mine started long before then, even before the Olympic Project for Human Rights. It started in from the cotton fields in the backwoods of Texas to the cotton fields in belly of California, Central California, which was from Fresno, California, down to Bakersfield, California, working in the fields day and night, getting out of class in grammar school, going to the cotton fields in high school, feeding the hogs and milking the cows. And so I had a section of my life dedicated to proactive movement, you know, before the athletic scene happened. And I saw my dad do certain things. Dad, mom never saw me run. And I ran a few races, and some of my races were pretty good. I said so myself. And so that was on my mind the whole time, to bring forward the best I had. And what I had was culture from my childhood all the way up through Lemoore High School, through San Jose State University, to meeting Dr. Harry Edwards, and even now, moving with him as we move through this path. This is another path. This is another bridge we're crossing. We're crossing a bridge with the young folks now who are making a stand. And they're very, very, very powerful. I know the question was direct, and I know I'm digging holes around it, but basically this is my issue. My issue has been total throughout the time. You know, Mexico City was one of the first times I stepped out to do something. The rest of the time, I was thinking about how I was going to do it. That was a path for me to do something silent that made a difference. And I think we made that difference that stands forever, and I will be talking about this forever because it is my life. That was my life and is my life now. But I had to get the education to do that. You know, I use my education differently than a lot of folks. I'm a simple guy who likes kids, so I use mine mostly on the kid platform. Every so often, I would jump up and do this with the people like Harry in Wyoming, but I'm basically a kind of a control type of attitude person. But this does not limit me from doing things on a big level.
And Wyoming, what about you? What about winning that medal and then knowing that you were risking this personal glory for a greater glory?
Well, you know, when you think about it, athletics was a vehicle. And it was a vehicle for me, and that I got an education. My parents couldn't send me to college or anything like that. So I got a work aid scholarship. And when it was unheard of for women to get anything like that, Tennessee State was one of the first schools, Tuskegee was probably the first school to ever give a scholarship to a woman in sports. And so the fact that, you know, that I could get an education and have opportunity to travel around the world. All those things were very, very, very meaningful to me, but also my pride and who I am as a person, as a woman, and going back to, as Tommy was saying, my growing up, my parents worked very hard for us. I had three older brothers to really try to make it, and they know they could not send us to school, but they wanted us to be good people and be good to not just to each other, but when it comes to the world, they were pretty much advanced. I think about the fact that they even allowed me to run track when it was not a popular thing for women to do. And a lot of ridicule where, you know, muscles are ugly on girls and why would you do that? But my father was always saying, you know, you can do it. And he would tell my brothers all the time, look, she is just as good as you, if not better. And it doesn't matter if you're a girl or whatever. What you want is the best person on your team. And that's what got me through it. Now, for me, it was always being the best person at all the things that I can do, and especially being the best person as an individual. So for me, it was, when it came down to whether we go to the Olympics or not, I said, well, You know, you first have to make the team so before you can say you're going to boycott the games. And then by that time, it was not so much as going to be a boycott of the games. You could go and you could do whatever you want. So for me, I saw a light in the sense that, hey, the opportunity to do something was going to be at the Olympic Games. And if I could, if anybody would talk to me, which that was not happening, and not that I was a talker at that time, but that, you know, I had a lot of things to say. And one way was to dedicate my medals, to wear the black shorts, and to also be in total support with Carlos and Smith.
And you're talking about your lifetime and your character being dedicated to a cause, to something greater. Dr. Edwards, you have certainly dedicated your life, and leading up to the and following the 1968 Olympic protests, your dogs were mutilated and left on your doorstep.
Yeah, but that was, they were killing human beings.
You had boxes of hate mail, you had death threats. Yeah, I know you and Tommy both did. You talk about not being able to eat in a restaurant for fear of poisoning. You're surveilled. How do you manage to stay the course amidst all of that coming at you?
Because we've been through it before. I mean, this is one of the important things about understanding your history. You know, people, at that time, Dr. King was assassinated. I saw a president assassinated. I was trying to get ready for Bobby Kennedy to come up to Northern California on June 6th, working with students on campus, putting together placards and one thing another because he wanted a big, diverse crowd at his rally. He got assassinated. I was working on my master's thesis and going down to New York City because I used some of Malcolm's congregants to interview on February 21st, 1965. He was assassinated. So the fact that these people would be degenerate enough to kill dogs was mean they were killing human beings. I mean, at the end of it, all one has to look at history and understand that from the very beginning there have been movements, there have been prices paid, but we've not only come through it, we've come through it better. We went through a civil war in this country that killed more Americans than all of the other wars that America has participated in combined, but we came out of it better. We went through a bloody labor movement, but we came out of it better. We went through a civil rights movement that took three times as many lives from the turn of the century to the assassination of Dr. King as the attack on the Twin Towers in New York City, but we came through it better. And so in understanding that history, one has to be optimistic because at the end of the day, we, the people, have always picked up the pieces and we've come out of these things better. I have tremendous faith in the decency, in the commitment of we, the people, and that's what we tend to do, is to pick up the pieces, pull things together, and we come out of these things better.
And you talk about coming out of things and about history and movements of the past, but I think when people are in the midst of a movement, they don't necessarily realize they're making history. And I know there's a lot of discussion these days about protest and sports and the role of politics and sports. How would you respond to critics who say that sports should not be politicized?
Well, fundamentally, that is based on ignorance. Sports are invested with the deepest felt values, with the deepest felt and secular values of the society. It's not accidental that we look at sport and we see an ideological foundation founded on a commitment to competitiveness, discipline, hard work, religiosity, even patriotism. It's not accidental that virtually every league and conference in this country cuts some kind of deal with military interest and so forth around the whole theme of patriotism. Sports are political. They've always been political. They were political when they were segregated and African Americans were shut out of mainstream sports. They are political to this day to the extent that women are not given the respect and so forth that they deserve in sports. In point of fact, I consider the circumstances, status, and outcomes of women in American society to be the number one human rights issue in this country today. And I'm so happy about the Me Too movement, about people finally cracking down on and coming to grips with some of this male toxic, malignant masculinity that leads to this harassment and these rapes and the rest of it. But women athletes have a role to play in bringing all of that to the fore and making statements about that. Let me say one last thing about women in sports. One of the reasons I did not reach out to women in the 1960s was I felt that their circumstances were so fragile. To put that additional thing on them. Even most of them, most of the black women in particular, came from historically black schools. This was pre-Title IX. This was pre-Roe v. Wade. And so I really felt that that was not one that I could that I could justifiably put on them.
You're here to talk on a panel to Penn State students about sports protest and politics and the role of the 1968 Games. Why is it important for students of all ages to learn about the protest at these games and the legacy that they left? And Tommy, I'll start with you.
Well, my, that's it's a part of society, and it's been going on for a long time, and the platform is much wider now, so there's room for everybody to become involved. Now, get involved. Proactively get involved. You don't have to carry a gun to become involved on the level of doing good or even doing greater. You must have faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So don't view one's moving as having to have it right now. You must work for the implications of a future greater than now. Keep moving.
Wyoming?
Human rights is always going to be at the forefront, and we all have to participate. Some of us silently, some of us, we all do it differently, and we have to always appreciate how whatever a person is doing to help the cause, and the cause is always going to be needed help. I'm just a avid fan for women in sports, and as Dr. Edwards was saying, I just think that we all have to do something. We all have to put a good foot forward, so to speak, and that we have to make sure that we are showing the young people that are coming up, hey, we're all human. We all deserve rights. We all deserve equal rights. And it starts in the home. It starts with people speaking out, and whether they take a knee or whether they put their fist up, however they choose to do it, we have to learn to appreciate that.
Harry.
I think we have to understand history. The athletes in 1968 were part of what turned out to be a third wave of athlete activism, a third wave movement. We're now in a fourth wave of athlete activism. A fifth wave is inevitably going to come because of the size of the megaphone and the forum that these athletes have. I did a summer workshop with about 200 largely minority athletes, most of them between ages of about 9 and about 15. And I asked them, you can be one of three people. You can be President Barack Obama, you can be LeBron James, or you can be Steph Curry, but you can't be all three. And when I asked them to raise their hand, how many of you want to be Barack Obama? Three hands went up out of 200 kids. They wanted to be Steph Curry and LeBron James. That tells you the size of the megaphone that these athletes have. They inevitably are going to speak out because now they understand, especially in the age of the social media, the power that they have to actually initiate change. So I think that you have to understand that history in order to understand where we are today and what we're going through. But more than that, what is already well this side of the horizon, political horizon, as far as athletes are concerned.
Thank you all so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Tommy Smith, Wyoming Tyus, and Dr. Harry Edwards were involved in the iconic 1968 Olympic protests. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Lindsay Whistle-Fenton, WPSU.